Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1 cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Welcome to the Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and if you are a dog lover, this episode is for you. Because today, we are talking about Brembles, a very special border collie who lived 175 years, that is, dog years, making her one of the top 10 longest living dogs according to the Guinness World Records. And what makes this story even more special is that Brembles was vegan. In fact, she is considered to be the very first vegan dog in recorded history. As a treat for all of us, I have today with me Brembles' mom, Anne Heritage, who I consider to be a pioneer of the vegan movement. Just think how nowadays we have so many vegan dog food brands and products readily available. And all of that originated with Anne and Brembles' story. In our time together, we discussed her groundbreaking book, Bremble, The Dog Who Wanted to Live Forever, which I highly recommend. It is a short yet impactful read. Link to the book in the episode's notes. We also discussed the resurrection of the dire wolves, your local veterinary clinics being acquired by Mars, the chocolate bar conglomerate, cooking for your animals, and much, much more. You decided to feed your dog a vegan diet. And is there any health advantage to doing so? Because I guess people who are listening are thinking, you know, my dog, I want to spend unlimited time with that dog. He's my best friend. He's a member of the family. So they want the dog to be healthy. They want the dog to live a long time. So what do you say to those people?
Okay, so if you look at the longevity of vegan dogs, including my own, and the longevity of dogs that stay on a carnivorous diet, especially if they're on a commercial diet and it's not done by the carer, you see that vegan dogs do in fact live longer. They are healthier. People who have their dogs on a carnivorous diet will often say they get issues, especially skin issues, chronic diseases, cancers, over a relatively short period of time. And you find with vegan dogs, if you've transitioned your dog from a carnivorous diet to a vegan diet, you'll find normally any skin issues will clear up. Chronic health issues may vanish, like arthritis and so forth. My dogs did live very long lives. Bramble was 25, Floyd made 20, Lucky made 20. And I had 7 dogs. 2 were killed by vets. The rest lived to 19, 20, and 25. So basically, in my own experience, they just live much longer, healthier lives if they're fed properly. You do have to take on the responsibility yourself of researching what vitamins and minerals, you know, nutrients they need. Dogs need about 67 vitamins and minerals every day. And you can do this easily yourself. All the food I cooked for them was organic. A lot of it I grew myself. I grew all their veg and some of the fruits. Obviously, it's more tricky to grow rice and stuff, so I had to buy organic rice and lentils and CVP. But basically, it's cheaper. They are healthier. They like the food. Normally, a dog that's been fed on some rubbish out of a packet, basically, it's like feeding it junk food. And when you actually cook them a proper meal, you can see the difference in their enjoyment. So there's kind of multiple reasons to feed dogs vegan, and health would be at the top of the list.
What do you make of people's hesitation to feeding their dog a vegan diet because they assume that dogs are carnivorous creatures, you know? And I guess they do because, first of all, you look at the teeth and they have those long pointy teeth, and so you think of them as carnivorous?
I think it's lack of education. If anybody actually bothers to research it before they say that, dogs are actually scavengers. They can eat meat, they can eat plant-based, they can eat a mixture of both. So dogs have evolved to kind of eat what's around them. And, you know, dogs that are in natural surroundings will probably eat, you know, fruits and other little creatures they find. But the healthiest diet for a dog is plant-based, and they do enjoy it. So, all, you know, people may say, oh, it's unnatural, but then so are computers, TVs, cars, all the things people use. So it's not really a good yardstick to use. And I think one of the reasons people are hesitant to feed plant-based, it's not always that they don't trust the plant-based food, but they don't trust themselves. So I co-admin a dog food and dog health websites, and quite often we find people are saying, it all sounds really good, but they are too nervous to do it. And I would say to those people, do your research, look at the nutrients the dog actually needs, find out what the nutrients are in. And on our websites, we have a sort of master recipe which tells you all the nutrients they do need and what those nutrients are in. So once they've done their research, I would just say, you know, have a leap of faith and a bit of confidence, and look at all the vegan dogs out there that are thriving, and there are many, many out there now, and just put in the work, source the food, cook it properly, and just reassure yourself that, you know, you are good enough to do their food. You know, looking at it the other way around, you know, what are you saying about your confidence in yourself or how much you care about your dog if you're just going into a shop buying some rubbish in a packet or tin, which has all its own problems? A lot of it has industrial chemicals in, and you're just shoving this in your dog's mouth because you lack a bit of confidence. The other thing is, it's my belief that dog food companies and big pharma are kind of owned by the same interests. So as with human health, people are encouraged to feed themselves and animals in their lives kind of essentially what is junk food, and then they will get ill, and then they will go to the vet or the doctor, and big pharma steps in. So you're basically turning the dog in your care into a patient for vets to just keep selling you drugs for the dog. And they, you know, vets aren't great at managing chronic conditions. If something in the commercial food you're feeding your dog makes its skin, makes it have skin problems, you know, the best thing to do is take that muck out of the dog's diet and feed her properly. And then, you know, you don't need to shove big pharma drugs down their throats. Really, it's in people's hands. I just wish everyone would do a lot more research, and then, you know, they can see for themselves why plant-based dog food is better.
It's a really interesting point. I was about to ask you, you know, if it is healthier to feed your dog a vegan diet, then why are the big companies out there not pushing that, not pushing vegan dog food, and instead they are pushing the kind of, you know, crap food you mentioned.
There we are. Yeah, they're producing crap food because they want your dog to be unwell for a long period of time. They don't want to kill your dog immediately. They want your dog to be a patient for all their life, preferably. And so they're going to feed stuff. Some of it will be stuff your dog can eat, and other things they're putting, like industrial chemicals, will make your dog ill. And I think people are frightened to say this, and they think Big Pharma is going to come along and kill them. And that may well happen, because it's happened a lot with human health, where people have spoken out, they've ended up getting assassinated, basically, for speaking out. So I think people are frightened to say anything about it. But Big Pharma's perspective and dog food perspective is, the longer we keep them ill, the more drugs we're going to sell them. And, you know, anyone that's got a dog that goes to vets knows how expensive it can be. When we had dogs, if you needed a call out, if your dog had an accident or something like that, you know, you're paying £100 up front before you even got to the consultation or the drugs. You know, vets are expensive, and it's better to avoid them where you can if you feed properly and exercise properly. and do all those other things dogs need, like keep stress to a minimum, then, you know, hopefully you will be able to swerve around the vet and not go there. Because in my opinion, it's just my opinion, borne out by my experience, vets are not really there to help your dog. I know there'll be vets that think they're there to help your dog, but if they're selling drugs, they're probably not ultimately doing anything helpful in the long run. And all these drugs have side effects. And also, few human studies even, or animal studies are done where drugs, whether for people or dogs, are looked at in the way they interact with other drugs. So if your dog is on three different drugs, maybe it's got a problem with its heart and, you know, some kind of inflammation, something else, how are these drugs interacting with each other? Nobody bothers to do those studies. And if they could be bothered, they wouldn't, because that's not to their benefit. They want your dog ill for a long time.
Before anyone dismisses what you're saying as, you know, conspiracy, you know, about those different industries, big pharma.
Yes.
I need to mention a story that happened recently here in Quebec, Canada, where I live. There has been an earthquake here, and for weeks, yep. The big news was a report coming from I think the Anti-Corruption Bureau of Canada about how there were those big conglomerates coming in Quebec and purchasing veterinarian clinics. And those big conglomerates are also the ones having, you know, monopoly on dog food, cat food, you know, basically pet food, and monopoly on pharmaceutical products in the veterinary world. And it basically what was exposed is the fact that our local veterinary clinics were not owned by our, you know, local veterinarian. They were owned by big conglomerates like Mars. And yes, I'm talking about the chocolate bar, who are big owners of, again, pet food too. And so Mars comes in Quebec, purchases those local veterinarian clinics, makes the veterinarian sign NDAs that stop them from telling their clients that they are now a subsidiary of Mars. You know, they still keep that facade of being your local vet clinic. And they increase the prices of veterinary drugs because you can't get them anywhere else. Shocking. It's shocking because it's the life of some of the beings out there that we care about the most.
Absolutely. It's exactly the same in the UK. Now, all the vets, as far as I'm aware, nearly all the vets, are belonging to, like you say, conglomerates. And they're US conglomerates. So wherever you go here, you're going to get kind of more or less a uniform outfit, in as much as they will be selling the same stuff from the same people. And just to mention also, some of the dog food actually does kill the dogs outright. I don't know if you looked up at Sports Mix, I think it was called. They had 75 dogs, I think it was, killed by eating Sports Mix. So they'd probably put in some kind of industrial muck into this product. Maybe they put the wrong amount. They wanted to keep them ill for a long time, and it killed them instead. This is what you're looking at. I think people, maybe they're a bit more used to looking at the connections between the human food chain and companies like Monsanto, because as you know, lots of brands of human so-called food, junk food, ultimately are owned by things like Monsanto. So you're getting the same thing with dog food. You're getting the same at the top of the pyramid of, you know, finances. You've got Monsanto, and then all these products feeding into it are sort of subsidiaries of that. And it's very much like that with the dog food market. If people don't believe that, well, they can just research it, spend some time looking at, and, you know, tracing back the line of interest on it. Just follow the money, as they say.
You mentioned how you cooked food for your dogs. And, you know, if I think about my family, that's what the generation of my grandparents would do for their dogs. But I guess we lost that now. And we, again, like you mentioned, we don't feel confident to cook for them, like if it's not, you know, our place to do so. So can you say a few words about...
Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then add the final touch with two for $8 on select 2.5 or 3-quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 9/3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See lowes.com/rebates for details.
How we should maybe regain that confidence and cook for our dogs.
Yeah, I think it's really good time now to do that for your dogs and for yourself. Because of the political climate, which I won't go into because it's a whole other long thing, but I think people are going to have to start using their own resources a lot more. And I think the last generation of younger people, for whatever reason, I mean, in the UK, education has been dumbed down a lot, and people have not been taught. And also by the way families have gone, you've got families that are kind of being different than they were. Used to have maybe like a family where granny lived in the house and granddad and the kids and everybody was in the same place. And as families have moved into different patterns, you've kind of lost that link. So whereas you know, in the old days, you would have watched your granny make something from scratch, or your granddad might have been digging the garden and, you know, growing their own veg, and people have lost those skills. I'd be, you know, the first person to recommend people go and get an allotment, or if they've got some ground, or even a, you know, even a balcony, you can grow stuff, just to grow your own food as much as you can. Vegetables are just a simple one, and then you can feed your dog organic veg from your own garden. Even, you know, benign stuff like if you're going to go and buy your organic veg, that's had to come from somewhere. It's hung around on a shelf. There's nothing like picking something that you've grown yourself and taking it in to cook it in 5 minutes' time, because it's just an entirely different thing. So I think if people involve themselves in the process of producing their food more, and also just maybe learn, if you don't cook, learn how to cook. And just, I think it's really important to read things and do the research on the nutrients and then how to cook them. But with Brambles food, it was always just really simple. I started off as a teenager. I'd gone vegan myself, and I was quite skint when I was younger. And then I wanted to take on some rescue dogs. So I figured I'd looked at it all from a sort of nutritional point of view. And there was this American nutritionist called Adele Davis. And unfortunately, she was a meat eater and she did promote dairy. But she did have, aside from that, a lot of useful charts about what vitamins and minerals were in which foods and so forth. So I kind of researched the work of Adele Davis and used some of the values of the nutrients and put that into the recipes I was making. So I think if people just give it a go, be confident. And if you've got older people around, just ask them how they did things. And Brambles dinner was really simple. So I ate the same thing. We all had it out of the same pan every night. So it would be rice, lentils, veg, TVP, turmeric, bit of mint, stuff like that. And seeds put on after it was cooked, like chia seeds and flax seeds for the essential oils. And basically it was that simple, as to just bring it to the boil, let it simmer for a while for, you know, all the vegetable juices to go into the rice and stuff. And that's basically what they ate most of the time. I used to make biscuits from, but other than that, they'd get a few biscuits a day in case they were bored, but they just got one big meal a day. And it's so simple to prepare it. Just stick it all in a pan and let it simmer for a while. But obviously we use B12 as well in the form of yeast extract, because people will often say, what about the B vitamins? Well, you can take care of that with yeast extracts. So it's really easy to cook vegan food for your dog.
And an important question is, do they like vegan food? Are they enjoying it?
I think so. My dogs loved it. And on the website we have, somebody transitioned a dog a little while back, and she sent us some photos of her dog. The dog's eyes were like almost popping out of its head, and it's licking the plate and stuff. So a lot of dogs are being fed this crap that comes out of packet or tin. It's dry, stick a bit of water on it. It's been hanging around in a shelf for however long. And imagine what it's like to be eating that all the time. So then when they get something that's the veg is fresh, the stuff's been cooked for them there and then, and they can smell it while it's cooking and all that, they love it. I've never personally had a dog that didn't really like it. And also I fed them once a day because I don't think you need to keep feeding dogs all day. I'm not sure it's great for their digestion. So they would have one big meal a day. They would eat a big meal, then they would fall asleep, and that was it. They wouldn't be fed the next day until their evening meal. So, it works really well.
You remind me during COVID when everything started shutting down. I was volunteering for this organization and trying to get them sponsorships from pet food companies, and they would tell me, "Oh, now everything is closing down, so we won't get our food from China." And that's when I realized that most, pet companies out there make their food in China, where the standards for food control and quality control are really substandards. They're really below what would be judged acceptable in the West.
Yes, a lot of food that we use in the UK is not human, so-called human grade food, and this is basically a lot of bits of dead animals. I mean, you've probably seen the films yourself where a load of meat that's from, processes which we couldn't put in a human food chain, are put in with some other cereal filler and dye, and you get this thing being extruded out of a machine, and it's like this big horrible pink jelly thing, and then they make it into some kind of shapes and stick it in a bag and call it dog food. It makes me speechless, really. Someone would give their dog that. Would you give that to your child? Unfortunately, a lot of people do give that to their child, don't they? They give that sort of thing. It's come a long way. It's made from ingredients that, I mean, if you look at a dog food label, quite often it'll just say meat derivative cereal ash, something like that. You don't know where the animal flesh has been sourced, how long the creature's been dead, the conditions she or he was killed in, all that stuff. You have no way of knowing what's in it. So if you're doing it yourself, cooking it yourself, you know exactly what's gone in it.
Okay, I want to spend some time talking about Bramble. Am I pronouncing his name right?
She was a female, yes, Bramble.
So, how did you become the caretaker for Bramble? How did the love story with Bramble begin?
Well, I'd had no pets when I was younger, no dogs when I was younger. My dad wouldn't let me have a dog, so as soon as I moved out of the house, I thought, okay, I'll take on a rescue dog. And the first dog I got was called Floyd, and she lived till she was 20. And Floyd was the absolute love of my life, and she was so easy to look after. And like I'd never looked after a dog before, I thought, wow, this is so easy. I'll take on another dog. I can easily take on another one. I got Bramble, and Bramble was a bit of a mischievous and stubborn character. And when I got her, I thought, wow, what have I let myself in for? I found her in Wales in a rescue, and the day after we had taken her home with us, there was some sort of flood, and all the dogs in the rescue had died. So she got out just in time. She was, I could say, she was very smart, very stubborn, and I think that's what helped her longevity. She just didn't decide she wasn't going to die anytime soon. She just wanted to be alive for a really long time. So I had Floyd and I had Bramble. They got on really well when they were younger. As they got a bit older, Bramble became quite dominating, and we ended up walking them both separately. They had quite a lot of walking each day, and there was myself and my friend were walking with them, so they were kept apart quite a lot. But she was great fun, and she understood lots of things. I'd seen film when I got Floyd initially of somebody who had taught a primate sign language, and I knew it was impossible to learn to communicate with animals in a way that people maybe don't normally. When I got Floyd and then later Bramble, I spent a lot of time teaching them human language and also observing how they communicated. So it wasn't just one way. I wasn't sitting there teaching them and not listening to them. I was kind of watching, because obviously, as you know, with dogs, most language is body language. But I taught Floyd a lot of words, just pick up something, say ball, ball, that sort of thing. And Floyd was very, very smart and picked things up really quickly. And I learned to watch what she did. If she wanted something, she would go and stand by it and point her nose at it, that sort of stuff. These days, you've got this thing, I can't remember what it's called. There's some sort of mat with buttons on it, and people are teaching animals in their care to use this to communicate between themselves. So the dog will be trained how to use the buttons, and then she can say, walk, or when's dinner, and things like this. It's amazing. So people can now teach their dog how to use this stuff and have a conversation. But also, people need to, and probably a lot of people do, learn to understand dog behavior, which is largely, obviously, not verbal, largely body language. And also, dogs exist in a kind of different space than us in a way, because their main predicate is olfactory. They smell things in a much more intense way than we do. So, whereas we, if we're not blind, we largely see things, and obviously, we've got audio and stuff, but dogs are all about smell. So that's their experience of life. So basically, I tried to build a base of communication between us that we so we could work together, if you like, and understand each other. And it worked pretty well, really. So, Bramble was great fun. She could be a bit dominating. We used to walk her separately from other dogs because she was always looking to have a bundle, and obviously this is not a good idea. So we would walk her away from other dogs normally, because just a way of looking at other dogs, they would cross the road sometimes. But this wasn't because she was vegan, because all my dogs are vegan, but only Bramble was a bit like that. So she was a proper character, really. I think that's the best way of describing it.
Talking about smells, I was recently interviewing a vegan couple who made an art book about their dog called Reinhardt, and he's also their dog. He's also a border collie, and I found it amazing because they were talking about how they were feeding the dog a vegan diet and how they were influenced by you and by your book. And they mentioned Bramble, and we had, we exchanged a few words about that. And one point they brought up was since they started feeding Reynard a vegan diet, he started smelling better. And I know that there's a, I guess for many people, it's an obstacle. Dog smell is an obstacle to taking care of a dog. But have you noticed the impact of a vegan diet on the smell of a dog?
I can't say I have, because my dogs were only ever vegan from the minute they came to the house. They were just fed a vegan diet, so they never really smelled any different. But I take your point. I know when I started eating a vegan diet, I found, I know this sounds strange, but I found that if I was out somewhere in the countryside, birds would come a lot closer than they used to come. And I like feeding birds. So I actually think, if you eat garlic, you can kind of smell it through your pores and your sweat. I think if you're a carnivore, this does, meat moves through your tracks very slowly. And you do get that kind of pong of of death. I think you really do. I don't think carnivores notice it themselves, but I think animals pick these things up. And I think it must be that basically you are what you eat and you smell like that's what you eat. So probably that's the case with dogs that, they're just eating veg and grains and there's not that horrible kind of smell of corpse going through their tracts, basically.
It's the first time I'm hearing that, and I thought it was just in my head that, animals change their behavior around me since I became vegan, that, they're less, I guess, afraid, or, they're more, inclined to get closer and things like that. So I'm happy to witness to see that there are other vegans out there who are experiencing that.
Yeah, I think that's really the case. So you don't smell like a predator anymore when you're just eating vegetables and fruits and stuff. So I guess animals whose sense of smell is usually much more acute than ours are obviously smelling this person is not a threat to me.
So I mentioned how that vegan couple, Sol and Tom, were influenced by your book and by your story. So how did Bramble become a star?
Well, I kind of never think of her as a star. She was a family member, obviously, and when she got really, really old, I thought, and the other dogs as well. So I say Floyd lived to 20, and the rest, some got to 20, some got to 19. I thought, well, this diet and regime, because it was kind of like it was like a care plan, if you like, all those things that came together with the diet, the exercise, the stress reduction strategies, and so forth. Were really working and making me live a long time. And then I had interest from the press in the UK. Every so often someone would ring me and ask about Bramble because they'd heard about it from somewhere. And people kept saying you should write a book. And eventually a publisher in the UK asked me if I would write a book for them. So I wrote the book, which is why it's like it is. It's kind of like in sections which you can read in any order because they wanted me to write a workbook. But when I showed them the draft. They said, "Oh no, we can't publish that because there's things in there that wouldn't go well in the American market." I'd mentioned at the time that I was a lesbian, and they were like, "Oh, you can't say that in the States." And I just said, "Well, I'm not taking it out." So we parted company. Then I thought, "Right, I'm going to have to publish it myself." And as you know, I'm not very technically minded, so I wrote it, and I got some help with uploading it to Kindle and so forth and formatting it. From somebody who didn't know what they were doing, and it kind of went from there.
That's an amazing story. Yeah, it is available in Amazon. I will mention it in the introduction, but
Thank
please
you.
get the book. You can access the book. I will leave a link in the episode notes so you can get it there. I haven't yet read the book, but I ordered the book and I'm looking forward to reading it. Okay, so when did the Guinness, World Record, those folks, when did they get interested in Bramble?
The Guinness Book of Records was a suggestion from the Times reporter, I think it was the Times, came down to see Bramble and they said, "Why don't you put her in the Guinness Book of Records?" But to be frank with you, I wasn't at all interested because at that point I wasn't thinking so much about how that would be viewed, that people could then say, "Oh, look, she's the oldest dog and it's been verified and all that." She was just my family member and we just fed her how we fed her and we just enjoyed our lives. So I never did bother the Guinness Book of Records. So people say she's been in the Guinness Book of Records. No, she wasn't. We were asked, did we want to put her in? At that point, we weren't bothered. Also, to be honest, if you look at the history of the Guinness Book of Records, the family behind it are, in my opinion, I'll be careful what I say, but put it this way, not someone I'd necessarily be interested in interacting with. People can do the research themselves as to why that might be.
Now I'm intrigued.
I don't want to say too much on the radio. I don't want someone to come suing me, but I just made my mind up that they weren't very nice people when I thought about it later on. Many years later, I thought, should I do that? And I read some stuff about them and their families and where it all came from. I just thought, I don't want to interact with these people.
Well, I will look it up. I'm intrigued now. Okay, what I really like about what you've done in your story is that if we accept that feeding a vegan dog is healthier, that, you know, there's all of this corruption with the food system around dogs, and also big pharma, we can, you know, at some point we should be asking ourselves then, you know, if that is the case for my dog, then why is it not the case for humans? Why is it not the case for me? Maybe a vegan diet is also better for me. Maybe the food system for human food is not the best. And maybe there is corruption there too. So I like how, you know, and we come to it from, you know, the point of view, the angle of dogs. And then we can build a bridge to, you know, humans and our, you know, experience with the food system. Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. And also cats, any commercial food you're buying for a companion animal or even your kids, if it's commercial food, it's going to, in my opinion, it's going to have the same issues and problems with it. And people also say, oh, I haven't got time to cook. They say, why is your life so precious and busy? You haven't got time to look after yourself or the animals in your care. So I hope people will kind of think about that, look after yourself and your animals and prioritize your health and do things for yourself other than just outsourcing your health to people who don't have your best interests at heart.
And it's really a low-hanging fruit. You know, in this podcast, I don't really get into the health arguments. I don't know what to make of, you know, cholesterol indicators and levels of I don't know what. I'm not a nutritionist, and, you know, I get confused about this whole world. But I think we can all accept that cooking your food is better for your health than getting it from, you know, big corporations.
Absolutely. And if you think, I mean, I'm 67 now. My gran used to just cook. My mum did as well, but my gran would cook stuff my gran had made from the garden, bring it in. It's fresh. Just cook it from scratch. You know what's in it. Basically, I don't see how you can do any better than that.
I think that one of the weakest side to veganism. So I'm a vegan for ethical reasons, and yep. When I look at consistency in the way I live, I think the weakest part of it is how I feed my cat and how we feed our, you know, companion animals in general, because we give them, you know, animal products. And So, you know, what do you make of that? Because I often hear, you know, people making arguments against veganism and trying to find the inconsistencies, but they always miss the biggest one, which is, you know, we're caring for animals and we're feeding them animal products. So in a way, we're still participating in supporting animal exploitation.
Yes, I mean, vegan cats is a good case in point. When I started feeding dogs vegan food, initially there was no problem, but many years later and people started realising that they were thriving, then they would be saying, oh, they're natural carnivores, you shouldn't feed them vegan. And I think people are accepting more now that actually they're scavengers and you can feed them vegan. When you say about cats to people, you could feed your cat vegan, people tend to be outraged and say this is a natural carnivore, they need a higher amount of protein than dogs, which is true, and so on and so forth, they need taurine. So you know, you have to say to them, you know, again, do your research, what cats need is a high concentration of the amino acids that are in protein. A lot of people don't really understand protein. Protein, in inverted commas, is not a thing. It's a combination, as you know, of amino acids. So the cat doesn't need this thing called protein. It needs these specific amino acids in specific amounts. So you can now feed cats on plant-based food. But you know, you have to be careful with all animals and people what you feed them, because obviously their life's depending on it. But just think, if you're feeding commercial rubbish all the time, I mean, I've got a family member who's not vegan who feeds her cat packets of stuff. She buys the packets because they're pretty colour and they say things like salmon on the front. But you know, if you took that to a laboratory and analysed it, I'm pretty sure you'd find all kinds of nasty commercial stuff in it, and you know, drugs are not supposed to be there, industrial stuff, and there might be a bit of salmon in there or not somewhere. People don't look at the opposite and take this filth, basically, they're feeding their animals in their care, and analyze it. But as soon as you say you could feed your dog or your cat vegan, then you get, you know, a big rumpus. So basically, even with cats, you can feed cats vegan, and there is commercial vegan cat food out there. They do need taurine added. Dogs do not need taurine added in their food, because dogs can make taurine in their bodies from other substances. Cats can't do that, so cats do need taurine supplements, but dogs don't. So you can feed a cat vegan. So I think often the trouble is with anything, as you know, if people have to change, or they you're thinking of trying to change someone's mindset so that animals don't suffer from error, and the animals that we look after. Because obviously, if you're feeding a cat in your care dead cow, then that's very inconsistent. The cows have to go through a slaughter process for the cat in your care, because you're prioritizing the rights of the cat and completely forgetting about the cow. So obviously that's not consistent. And obviously, we all do that all the time. If you drive on a road, there are animal products, you know, that make the things that roads are made up of. So some things are easier to change, and some things are really not easy to change. But with cats, you can do that. But again, you've just got to do your research and take the time to make the food, and you know, have the confidence to do that. Again, there are a lot of thriving vegan cats now. Not you know, many, but you know, many more than there were. I think there are vegan cat and dog groups on things like Facebook.
So a random question: what do you make of those, you know, words we use around animals? So I try to you know, be careful about not saying pet. So I say companion animal, yeah. And I don't say I own them. I say I care for them. But part of me thinks, why am I, you know, using my language that carefully? You know, there are animal rights activists out there, you know, vegans who, you know, made the argument that, no, you should be using pet. Use the language that, you know, most people use. That's the case, for instance, for Matthew Scully. He says, you know, using the word pet for my animals, for the animals I care about, does not, you know, make them lesser than, or it's not a marker of, you know, I'm not trying to be offensive to them or something, like, doesn't take away the love I have for them to call them pets. And so what do you make of that?
I think language is crucial. Imagine if you had someone that was working for you against their will, like forced child labor and mining lithium or something, and you said to that person, you're a slave, but I really love you and I really care about you, but you are a slave. It doesn't really matter what I call you. I think if we put it in relation to humans, we can see why that's not a good idea. You know, you if you have a partner, so you're male with a female partner, you know, you could call her something offensive. It wouldn't really matter, because she knows you love her. But I think it's really important. It educates people. If you say my dog, well, it's not your dog. Even companion animal is a funny one when you think about it, because no animal chooses to come and live with you. You go and, people that don't care will go and buy them from a breeder, and people that do care will go and buy them from, acquire them from a rescue. But you are going to pick out that animal because of the way it looks or the way it behaves, or hopefully, if you're a decent person, because it needs you to help him or her. So to calling it a companion animal, it kind of says this animal has chosen to come and live with me and be my company, and they come everywhere with me and they do what I want to do when I want to do it. But all those things really miss a huge power base of the control we have over them. And it's partly, largely our fault, but also something we can't do that much about because of the kind of urban situations we live in a lot of the time and the way the world is. So you can't really allow a dog to just, when I was a younger, in the say the 60s, people in the UK would just put their dog outside the door and the dog would stay out all day and do what it wanted to do and go home again. And there was less chance of her or him getting run over. These days you can't do that, but that was some little degree of autonomy an animal might have. But so now animals have really no real autonomy and they have no real agency when we decide that we're going to control their whole lives. So calling them a companion is a bit of a misnomer because they didn't choose to be our company. We have brought them into our homes. We lock them in, we take them out when we want to take them out, feed them when we want to feed them. Nothing is under their control. And that's another thing I put, kind of just put in my book a little bit, trying to get people to think of how a animal's life is structured from the animal's point of view. From, when they get up in the morning to when they go to bed at night, everything is planned for them, even if they're neglected or by somebody or whatever. All that's done by human agency, and that they have no choice. So kind of calling them a companion animal is better, I think, than calling them a pet. But in a way, calling them a pet is kind of saying it like it is, I guess, because you're saying you're there for my amusements and, because I want you here. And probably if you could manage on your own, you'd wander off and I wouldn't see you again, that sort of thing. So I guess it depends if you want to be polite and say a companion animal or just be realistic and just, you could really, if you thought about it, just say, actually, this is my captive, because that's what they are. They are your captive. They are a captive animal. It's not like a dolphin in a tank, in as much as they've got tiny tanks and it's all just vile for them. But your cat or dog, the cat or dog you look after, has no choice in where they are, basically. They probably love you in the same way as people get Stockholm syndrome when they're kind of kidnapped and stuff like that. After a while of living with someone, you kind of get used to them and you quite love things you like about them and stuff like that. I wonder if so-called companion animals, do they get a bit of Stockholm syndrome because they rely on you for everything, and in that they have no choice. I've recently tried to help a dog that somebody has got. They're not treating her very well, and this guy really loves her, in inverted commas, but he treats her like dirt. We've been trying to get her removed, but she still will walk with him, or if he's sat outside, she will go over to him. And this is kind of like Stockholm syndrome. I think really, if we were to use brutally factual language, we would have to say something like the animals are captives, however well-meaning we are.
I like that. I'm more of a realistic, pragmatic person, so I think I'm going to go back to using pets as a term. Those are fascinating points. Do you think that vegans make the best? I was going to say caretakers, but captors for animals, because I rescued a couple of birds, budgies, and I don't keep them in their cage. I let the cage open. Of course, they fly in a safe environment. There's nothing that can harm them. I made sure of that. And, you know, I was reflecting on the level of care I provide for them and how much I think about their well-being. And I thought, do I really trust someone who is not vegan to care for those two birds? And so I ask you the question, do you think there is something about being vegan that makes you the best potential candidate to rescue an animal?
I try and think of people as individuals. So I guess you'll have vegans who've got a lot of time and are very thoughtful. Other vegans might be very busy and take on an animal to look after, but maybe not quite have enough time that it needs, albeit they mean well. I'm wary of lumping people together because there are so many different kinds of vegans. If you say as a base that a vegan is somebody who has ethics of animal rights in mind and kind of goes from there, that's a good base level. And then, of course, you'll just get millions of different kinds of vegans with different ways of doing things. So I suppose, theoretically, you might get somebody who wasn't vegan that took their dog out for lots of walks and had a whale of a time. I might get a vegan who, you know, cared about the ethics of looking after their dog and didn't have much time, and maybe she didn't, the dog didn't get out so much. So I guess vegans, if they're actual vegans for animal rights reasons, then that's a very good start. But I guess you can't think of everybody in the same way because they're all individuals.
Lastly, Anne, I wanted to bring up something that has been on the news and getting lots of attention. Have you heard about the dire wolves getting resuscitated?
Yes. And you've got to wonder why. I mean, from the dire wolf's point of view, they've been born in a laboratory. They will never be free to roam because the scenario that they would have been born in, you know, back in time is completely different. I know even with, not even, but with wolves that aren't dire wolves, I read a book once about this woman who had some wolves that she was looking after in a quite large compound, but it just wasn't big enough for them. They are wild animals. They don't want to be confined. I think it's extraordinarily cruel, really, to breed things like dire wolves into a laboratory situation. And even if they've got a biggish compound, everything that they evolved to be and to do and interact with is not here now. And this is just a very different world. I can't see from their point of view how that's helpful. Also, the whole process, I'm not sure if this is how it was done, but I know you can clone dogs now, not just wolves. And the whole cloning process is fraught with ethical issues. For each clone that survives, maybe, you know, there are other clones that didn't survive that were born or whatever, and they then died because something had gone wrong. And this just seems so pointless and to inflict suffering on people. I can't see that the dire wolves will have much of a life. They'll just be always this kind of like unique creatures that's, you know, they're out of their time and out of the environment they evolved to be in. I'm not really sure that there are any upsides for the dire wolves, personally.
I heard the story of how they got the DNA for those dire wolves. They they got them, I think, from pups that were, you know, cadavers, of course. And from, I think, the head of the mother of those pups, and, you know, they were driven to extinction by humans, obviously, and the last, you know, specimens with, you know, viable DNA in them were in the basement of a museum, and, you know, to think there were pups, like, and their mother, just the head, you know, it's kind of, you understand how cruel people were to those dire wolves. Don't you think that bringing them back is a form of justice, I guess, a way to, repair things, injustices that were done in the past by humans?
I think if you applied it to humans and said, we did kill your great-great-great-grand, but we're bringing back a clone of her, what would we think differently about it? The individuals that were killed are now dead, long gone. Nothing can ever be justice for them because their one life was taken from them. And that somebody in the future, way in the future, looks a bit like them, has got, was it probably 95% wolf DNA plus direwolf DNA. That ship has sailed for those dogs. They're now gone. They don't exist anymore. So I can't see it. Personally, I can't see it like that.
And what do you make, I guess, of the whole concept of bringing back species? Because that company that brought back the dire wolves, they want to bring back holy mammoths. And they've created that mouse, that mammoth mouse, which has gotten a lot of attention online. They say they won't be selling specimens, but you know, as of now, we don't know, you know, in the future if they're going to start selling, you know, mammoth mouse and things like that. What do you make of that whole experiment?
It just sounds like an awful extinction of the so-called pet trade, doesn't it? It's just they've been created for commercial reasons, presumably, and down the line they're hoping to do something like that, no doubt make money from it. So from an animal rights point of view, I can't see any pluses for the animals that would be born and then exploited in that way.
And what about the environmental argument that, you know, bringing back dire wolves and holy mammoths will benefit ecosystems?
Well, I think probably most of the ecosystems are vastly, I'm not an expert on this, but just my opinion, I think all the ecosystems that were there when the dire wolves and woolly mammoths were about are disappeared. Where I live in the southwest, in Bristol, I think it was Bristol Museum, there was a woolly mammoth skeleton or something like that at one point, and was it a big deer? Anyway, this creature lived in that area. Well, it's all built up now. They could never return to the area where they had evolved initially. So they would have to go somewhere else. I can't see the point. I don't think that the ecosystems would benefit from that. I know if you've got wolves in a country, they are really vital to the ecosystem. With a kind of waterfall of effects or benefits for that ecosystem. But isn't it better to care for the wildlife that live there now? You know, a non-dire wolf will do that if she lives there already. Why go to all this expense breeding and, you know, oppression and exploitation, breeding somebody in a laboratory to put them back somewhere where the ecosystem has gone? And you could equally do that with the native species that are there now anyway, if we just left them alone. Obviously, wolves are highly persecuted for sport and by farmers and stuff.
Yeah, the whole thing sounds like a Frankenstein situation. There's a sense that, you know, it's a horror movie of some kind that we're watching. And I, you know, the first thing I thought about when that story broke out was, what about, you know, hominids, other human species? Are they bringing them back too, or is this like a line they would not cross? It's a fascinating.
Good point. That's a very good point, because people will probably turn off the podcast at this point, but again, if people do their research, they will see that now there's an agenda with, obviously you've heard of transhumanism, but I think we've gone a step nearer that lately with the COVID vaccines and with the ingredients in that jab they're saying now, and you know, this is checkable, it's not conspiracy, it is checkable on the internet, that because of the stuff in the COVID vaccine and the DNA, because there's DNA from fetuses in there, two fetal lines are in vaccinations, and there's other stuff like monkey DNA, dog DNA in the vaccines, that people that have had those vaccines no longer qualify as humans, they now qualify as transhuman. But that means that the company or the companies that manufacture those vaccines now own those people legally, because those people are not now classed as human, and therefore they have no human rights. And that is checkable. People can look that up.
Yes, I think we're going into a very weird future, like a not dystopian, but something, yeah, weird is the best word I can think about. Like, we need to now get comfortable with the idea of weirdness.
Absolutely. And it's all planned out, I think, with long-term plans of people that run things behind the scenes, if you like to call them that. And I think we're all going to be getting digital IDs. You're going to get blockchain stuff, all this going on, and we're going to get much more totalitarian societies globally. And this is not a good future for humans or animals, really.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, as long as we have free speech and platforms to discuss these things, we have a chance to for a brighter future.
In the UK, in the UK during the COVID thing, lots and lots of things were censored on the net. So I'm not sure in the UK if we do have much free speech anymore.
Yes, I mean, I have to agree with that. Canada was the same. We don't really have much, you know, not comparable to, you know, we don't have free speech laws and rights comparable to that of the US. You know, if the standard is, you know, the US, then yeah, we're short of that, of course. And that also includes the UK and most democracies out there.
Absolutely. So we're in trouble in a way. And just briefly, other things for people to think about with dog longevity, we're getting a lot of poisons put in the air now. There's a lot of, I think they call it stratospheric aerosol injection, otherwise known as chemtrails. The US are now looking at that to stop it. So people think that they don't exist or they're just contrails, but if they will again do the research, you can see there's lots of nasty things being dropped on us. I'm just looking at some trail planes go past, I'm sat in my car. And also electromagnetism, there's so many devices around, computers, handheld devices, 5G towers, all this stuff. I think this will be affecting companion animals as well as ourselves, because, you know, you're having microwaves if you live near a tower, so on and so forth. I won't go into all the gamma solvics, it's a kind of like a whole other subject, but there's lots of things now that will cause problems to animals and their longevity that when Bramble's live that they didn't exist. So I think in the UK, a lot of animals seem to be dying off at quite a young age now, and that seems to be tied to some things like these 5G towers and so forth. But that's kind of, nobody's actually researching it. That's just kind of anecdotal evidence that we hear through our website or, you know, people that we know.
Yeah, what is certain is that, you know, people are now very distrustful of authorities and experts and the kind. Yeah, not like before, that's for sure. And maybe that's for the better. And maybe as parting words, I would love if you could maybe share, you know, what was the reception from publishing your book and getting it out there? What kind of, how did people respond to that book?
In a very positive way. I haven't had any negativity at all, none. As far as the book goes, people do worry about feeding vegans sometimes. So there's that. But the actual book itself got a lot of good reviews, and it helped start the vegan dog movement. There's a lady called Butterflies Cats who did some work on documenting vegan dogs. I think she did something like 100 vegan dogs. She put that out there. And I brought my book out a similar time. So she mentioned Bram also when the book came out, and Butterflies had done what she'd done. People became aware that there were vegan dogs. We've now got a website. I think it's called Vegan Recipes for Dogs Plant-Based. And there are other vegan dog websites. So I think it's helped, you know, it's been one component of promoting a vegan dog movement. So the reception has been overwhelmingly positive. And kind of that's, you know, for me, that's a good outcome. And Bramble would have loved it if she would, and you know, she'd been around and she understood that her existence had helped people to realize you can feed plant-based. And then she would be happy to, I think.
Yes, it's a beautiful thought. So, Anne, before I stop the recording, did you want to add something?
Only to people, don't be afraid of feeding vegan. Read up on it. Give your dog good food. Take time to feed yourself and your dog properly. Look after yourselves. And be aware there are ongoing hazards for animals out there that may not be immediate apparent, like the chemtrails, but they are having a massive effect on the flora and fauna, and that will include us and our companions, our companion animals. And just to thank people for all the positivity and love we've got back over the years from talking about Bramble. We really appreciate it.
Wonderful. I'm looking forward to reading your book, Anne, and I want to thank you for having taken the time to come by and answer my questions. It's really appreciated. Thank you so much, Anne. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.